Shall we start?
Sure.
Yeah, so it's a pleasure to have Alan Adams here from MIT. He'll be talking about SU3 manifolds and read fantasy.
Thanks. So I want to tell you a little bit about some progress on studying non-Kähler manifolds in string theory, and in particular studying the moduli space of non-Kähler manifolds with SU3 structure in string theory. This has some fun connections to the Reed fantasy. That's perhaps tangential from the point of view of string theory, but pretty entertaining from the point of view of the manifolds. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the description of general SU3 compactifications in string theory, just sketch, remind you what the Strominger system is, or the set of heterotic equations of motion, and build you some explicit examples of SU3 manifolds which are not Kähler, not Calabi-Yau. Show you a conformal field theory which computes things like the cohomology ring, the quantum cohomology ring on these manifolds, and build you an example where two manifolds, one of which is Kähler and one of which is not, are smoothly connected as conformal field theories, even though their connection as manifolds is not smooth in any sense. And this will be a Reed-like transition that I'll try to make very precise. It's something that we would not be able to do as a smooth geometry, and that none of our usual tools in string theory of studying smooth geometry, in particular gravity, would be useful for. We have to come up with a more sophisticated or conformal field theory description. So part of the politic I really want to argue is that the right place to be asking questions about the Reed fantasy and the connectedness of the moduli space of SU3 manifolds is in the context of conformal field theory rather than in the context of the geometry properly. Okay, so the basic gig in string theory, of course, is that, at least from some point of view, we want to get 4D physics out at the end of the day. And what this really corresponds to is some six-manifold. And we care an awful lot about supersymmetry in the 4D physics. This is just the statement that we want an SU3 structure on manifold. And in particular, we want a nowhere vanishing spinner on our manifold. The set of massless fields, in the 4D physics correspond to the moduli of this SU3 structure. So one of the most basic things you can ask about in string compactification in this point of view is the moduli space of SU3 structures. So what do I mean by an SU3 structure? Suppose I'm going to start with a manifold, call it X, with a nowhere vanishing spinner. So in particular, this tells us that there exists some connection del such that del eta is equal to 0. Del on the spinner is equal to 0. The spinner is covariantly constant with respect to something because it's nowhere vanishing. So I can just define parallel transport by hand. Meanwhile, we can build a Hermitian 2 form. We can build a complex structure. We can build a nowhere vanishing 2 form J, which is not equal to 0. J is equal to eta dagger gamma mu gamma nu mu eta. And this guy raise an index in squares to 1, so this tells us the manifold is complex, and according to this complex structure, J is Hermitian. Say J is Hermitian. Importantly, it's not true that del is the Levi-Civita connection of the metric associated with this Hermitian form. In general, it's going to be the Levi-Civita connection plus some additional piece. This is almost up to stupid changes uniquely determined, which is Bismuth's theorem. An important point here is that if H is equal to 0, then DJ is equal to 0. So we have an SU3 manifold with a good closed Kähler form, so this is Calabi-Yau. Okay. It's a Kähler SU3 manifold. If h is not equal to 0, then the spinner is not covariantly constant with respect to the metric connection. It's not a Calabi-Yau. And in particular, it's not Kähler. Dj is not equal to 0. So this is some non-Kähler manifold. OK, so these are sort of the two basic steps we can make. So there's some understanding so far of these kind of manifolds. These generalized Kähler manifolds are examples. WZW models give other good examples from the point of view of string theory. So a basic question is the moduli space of SU3 structures, and in particular, whether it's connected. So superficially, the answer should be no, right? The moduli space of SU3 structures, of SU3 manifolds, needn't be connected. I mean, they're topologically inequivalent Calabi-Yaus, right? So on the face of it, this looks implausible. Of course, we know that there are topology-changing transitions on the moduli space of Calabi-Yaus. You can go through a flop transition where you switch from one Calabi-Yau to a birationally related one. Of course, those are very special. They're birationally equivalent. But how do we do that? How do we get a flop to be a good, smooth modification of a Calabi-Yau? And the answer is, well, you slightly decorate the Calabi-Yau. It's not just a Calabi-Yau with some metric, but it's also got some V-field on it. You complexify the metric and work with a complexified Kähler class, rather than working with just the manifold. So the point I want to emphasize here is that in order to see something which is you know, naively topology changing in any sort of classical geometry and thus singular, in order to see that as a well-behaved object, as a well-behaved transition, you need to decorate the manifold in some way which isn't classical. So this is going to be a basic move that I'm going to employ in the rest of this talk. We're going to take some manifolds that look like they're topologically completely inequivalent. We're going to decorate them appropriately. Here we're going to find a very specific set of decorations, and we'll find a transition which changes us from being a Kähler to a non-Kähler SU3 manifold in a way which is completely smooth when you take into account the decoration, much like the flop is completely smooth once you take into account the imaginary part of the Kähler class. Okay. So that's going to be the basic move. Okay. So to get at the problem that we really care about, or that I'm going to care about for this talk, let me remind us of some of the features of the Reed fantasy. So let's just remember the conifold first. So in the conifold, we have some geometry, which is some S3 times an S2, where the S2 doesn't shrink. We have a cone over S3 cross S2. The S3 is contractible, and the S2 is not. And this is, of course, Ricci flat non-compact cone. So we can take this to a singular point where we blow down this S2. And we can, of course, deform up the S3 to now being S2, S3. And so we can arrive at the singular limit by either shrinking down the S3 or blowing down the P1. And we can think of this as, of course, just the usual Clemens-Friedman surgery, where you have a nice P1. You put a curtain and don't look at what's going on behind the screen. And you cut it out, glue in an S3, take away the curtain, and lo and behold, you have your happy manifold. So the conifold surgery is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. If you have a nice non-compact Calabi-Yau, you find some P1, you cut it out, you glue in the S3, everything's smooth, you've preserved the canonical class, so you started off with a Calabi-Yau and you end up with a Calabi-Yau. It's a completely reasonable thing to do. That's true if it's non-compact. But if you're compact, things get much more exciting. And this was what Reed got giddy about. Sufficiently giddy that he didn't want to call it a conjecture, but just a fantasy. And there are two ways to see the important lesson of Reed's argument. One is the original statement: take all take some Calabi-Yau. Okay, it's got H112 signs, and blow all of these guys down and perform the surgery, the Clemens Friedman surgery, on each shrunken P1. Okay? What you get is a manifold, which I'll call M tilde, so call me out M, and take all H11 P1s to zero. What you get is some resulting manifold, which is manifestly SU3. The construction is local, the surgery is local, so you know you preserve the canonical class, you know you're always trivial C1. But this has H11 equals zero. So this can't be a Kähler manifold. So whatever this is, it's not Kähler. But it's still SU3. Okay. So to the degree that such a surgery is a reasonable thing to do, you're sort of inevitably stuck in the situation where Kähler manifolds and non-Kähler manifolds can be connected. Now, of course, you say, well, this is a surgery. This is clearly not a smooth thing to do. So we really don't have to worry at all. Except in string theory, one of the lessons we've learned is that there's a very real sense in which this is a totally reasonable transition. It's totally smooth. In particular, in type 2 string theory, as Strominger pointed out, as you shrink down this P1, there are additional states in the theory, in the string theory, which come from membranes which wrap this P1. And as the P1 goes to zero volume, those membranes go light. They go massless. And you have to treat them on the same level as the moduli, the massless moduli of the Clavius in the first place, with the original SU3 manifold. So in string theory, this is a completely smooth process. So it's a natural question. Is there some general statement in string theory, or in some generalization of complex geometry, where the local conifold, or the conifold surgery that connects these two manifolds, the Clavius and the non-Kähler one, is completely smooth? And so can we connect if we have some Clavius moduli space, and it has some particularly some boundary points where we perform the surgery and connect on to the moduli space of non-Kähler manifolds? So this looks like a very sort of stringy and not terribly geometric presentation. So in some sense, it would be nice if we had something that was a little cleaner, a little more directly geometric than the conifold transition in type 2 with a bunch of grains wrapping these P1s, shrinking down and going massless. So the big picture of the Reed fantasy is to ask the question, are all Clavius connected by motions off the Clavius moduli space on the moduli space of non-Kähler manifolds with a non-Kähler SU3 manifold? So can I always pop off of a Clavius by going through some conifold transition to a non-Kähler manifold, cruise around, and end up on some distant Clavius? So this is sort of the fantasy. And the problem is, except for in very special cases, we don't know how to study this even in string theory, much less directly in any sort of complex geometry. So one of the machines I want to build for you today is a set of tools to study transitions of this form in conformal field theory. So here we're going to be studying, instead of the manifold directly, we're going to study conformal field theory whose target space is the geometry of interest. And we'll find transitions where this sort of shift from the Clavius phase to a non-Kähler phase is completely smooth. It's completely smooth in the conformal field theory. Question? No. So so one of the basic problems we run into immediately with this is that, so what was the sense in which this was non-singular? In the case of the flop, it was pretty clear why what we had to do to make things non-singular. We complexify the Kähler class, and that's enough. That takes us an awfully long way. In this case, we have to do something much more dramatic. We have to introduce something that's not at all geometric, these new membranes wrapping the P1s getting light. And this is, in string theory, it's something that's very non-perturbative. Geometrically, it's something sort of by hand. So we want a more explicit construction. So the construction I'm going to choose is to use the heterotic string theory. And so it's a slightly different string theory. And in particular, in the heterotic string theory, for the purposes of this talk anyway, there are no analogous non-perturbative effects like these wrapped membranes to desingularize this transition. So as you take the P1 small, there are no two brains, there are no membranes to wrap on the shrinking P1 in order to desingularize the geometry, to smooth things out. So something else has to be going on. On the other hand, the hadronic string has a lot of other perturbative ingredients, a lot of other features in its conformal field theory. It has other decorations of the manifold other than just the B field. And it's those other decorations which, just as in the flop case, will desingularize the conformal field theory. So what do I mean by all that? So when we start with when we study a hadronic string theory on some manifold X, we start with more than just a specification of the Kähler class, or the complexified Kähler class. We also have a vector bundle over X. Okay, so this is going to be our new decoration for the manifold. And instead of studying, as we would in type 2, Ricci flat manifolds, we're going to study holomorphic vector bundles on X, where X is SU3. Okay, so more specifically, we have on this vector bundle a curvature F, which is going to be a holomorphic, the curvature of a holomorphic connection. We have our Kähler class on X, which I'm just going to call J. And X, really I mean the complexified Kähler class there. But and we have a series of differential equations which are the analog of Ricci flatness. So in the Calabiano case, we would have just studied Ricci flatness. In the more general SU3 case, in the hadronic string, we have a set of equations, F wedge J is equal to 0. Let's say we're working on a 3 form for the moment because we're studying SU3 manifolds. There's this there's H, which is equal to I D minus D bar J. So in particular, if this is not equal to 0, then J is not closed, and the manifold isn't Kähler. We have the analog of the Kähler condition, though, which is that D of some normalization, which I don't want to go into, think of that as some constant, roughly, J wedge J is equal to 0. This is called balanced rather than Kähler. And finally, the big horrible equation, which is dH is equal to trace R wedge R, the Ricci 2 form, minus trace F wedge F, where again F is the curvature on the vector bundle. Okay. So, important thing to note is that if we took a Kähler manifold, then H would automatically be 0. And this tells us that the vector bundle has to satisfy C2 of, now as forms, not just as the classes, of Tx is equal to C2 of the vector bundle for X. Of course, as cohomology classes, this always has to be the case, but this has to be true locally if H is equal to 0. So on a Kähler manifold, we'd be studying, you know, some simple deformations of tangent bundles is the sort of simple case. But these are the equations we're going to have to solve. And they're clearly much more complicated than Ricci flatness, which is what we would normally study in type 2 on a Calabi-Yau. So this is at the level of differential geometry, this is a much, much messier set of examples. And indeed, when these equations were first written down by Strominger in something like 86, he immediately said, look, finding solutions to these equations, and in particular, this equation, which is horribly nonlinear, right? H is expressed in terms of the Hermitian form. And of course, the curvature is given in terms of the Hermitian form. And implicitly, I use the Hermitian connection here. So this is a horribly nonlinear equation, right? Really badly, much worse than just Ricci flatness. So forget trying to find a Calabi-Yau metric. Finding a solution to this is just orders of magnitude more difficult. So, initially, Strominger said, look, forget about trying to actually solve these equations. Let's just set H equal to 0. If we work in the case H equals 0, then we just get Calabi-Yaus. Okay? And so for 20 years, people work with Calabi-Yazan string theory and learn a tremendous amount about the non-perturbative structure of string theory. And it took 20 years before there was even an existence proof for solutions to these equations. Okay? Let's see, do I want to go in that direction? Yeah. Okay. So the existence proof by Fu and Yao, which was several years ago now, involved a very specific ansatz for the form of the manifold and the vector bundle. And most of what I'm going to talk about is in the context of that ansatz. So let me spell it out. No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. So if h is equal to 0, good question. So if h is equal to 0, we just get Calabi-Yau, and then it's the Yau proof of the Calabi theorem, there exists a solution. Okay? Because if h is equal to 0, then, you know, this is equal to 0, dj equals 0. Right? So we're Kähler, and, you know, everything simplifies. And incidentally, once you impose the C2 condition, all you have for the vector bundle is dy. And, you know, there's the dy theorem. So in the case h equals 0, it's Calabi-Yau, everything's very simple. The existence theorem I'm talking about is for the interesting case where these guys are not equal to 0. Okay? So this theorem was proven by Fu and Yao, and actually it's a little bit of a subtle story. Fu and Yao proved the solution, the existence of a solution to the set of equations, but there had been a sort of important sign error in the original paper by Strominger. So they later wrote a second paper, which proves the existence of solutions to the correct equations, which is sort of entertaining. So there are solutions to both, which is good to know. I should say this proof is really, I don't know if anyone's looked at it, it's really quite, I mean, it's a tour de force. These guys are very hardcore. And it's not terribly illuminating to the physics, but crucially, the proof depends in all sorts of ways on the particular ansatz I'm about to give you. So a general proof of the existence of solutions to those equations is sorely lacking. But we also know that these equations are a much more general set of equations, so the solutions of these equations are much more general than all the compactifications we already know in string theory. So this is a much larger set. There should be some much stronger statement about the existence of solutions, but no one has any idea about, you know, as far as I know, about how to prove the existence of solutions to those equations. So the ansatz they start with actually has a long pedigree, but let me not go into it in detail. They say, okay, look, let's take, if we just had it, well, suppose we have the easiest of Calabi-Yau's, it's interesting, K3, and we put a vector bundle over it, which we'll call, we call the K3 S. So S is going to be a K3. So we have some vector bundle over it, V of S. Perfectly fine. This is going to be some holomorphic vector bundle. It comes with some curvature. I'm going to decorate this manifold with an additional T2 fibration, which I'll call X. Okay. And if this is a holomorphic fibration, then I can pull back the vector bundle to get a vector bundle V over X, which is just the pullback. Okay. And let me call the curvature forms of the two circle bundles here omega I. Okay. So this is just some particular ansatz with ds squared on x is equal to e to the u ds squared on s plus d theta plus alpha I squared, where d alpha I is equal to omega. So this is just the two vertical one forms along the T2 fibration. This is just standard Kluze-Klein ansatz. And u depends only on the coordinates on the s. Okay. Meanwhile, the K3s has a nowhere vanishing 2 form, which I can call s. And there's a nowhere vanishing 1 form, which is just the two vertical fibers here, which I'll call theta, wedge theta. Okay, where theta is equal to theta 1 plus I. Alpha 1, d theta 1, sorry, plus I, d theta 2, plus alpha 2. So this is clearly a vertical holomorphic 1 form, if these are holomorphic vibrations. So I have a 1, 0 form, and I have on S the nowhere vanishing 2, 0 form. So this gives me a 3, 0 form, on the total space X, which is globally well-defined and nowhere vanishing. So that gives me an SU3 structure. Okay. And meanwhile, I have that H is equal to d theta plus alpha I wedge omega I. Okay. And this tells me that dH is equal to roughly omega I wedge omega I. So it's not equal to zero. Okay. So what's the defining data of this theory? Well, there are the omega I's, which are some classes in H2 of S. And in particular, I'm going to take them to be in H11 of S. So I'm going to circle all the defining data. We have the vector bundle over the K3 S, V of S. And in particular, that's determined by F and its Chern classes. And we have implicitly the Kähler class here on S. So we also have J on S. So this is our defining data for this ansatz. Fu and Yao proved that there exists, Fu and Yao took this ansatz and plugged it into this set of equations, which I'll call the Strominger equations because Strominger wrote them down. And they show that all of these equations are automatically satisfied, where, now I can tell you what this normalization was. It's the norm of this 3 form. Okay. They show that all of these 3 equations are automatically satisfied by this ansatz, and that this one remaining equation becomes a horrifically complicated differential equation, partial differential equation, for the one surviving parameter, which is this u. Right? U is the only undetermined thing in the ansatz. It's some function on the K3. And so finding an existence to the Strominger solutions for this ansatz boils down to finding the existence of a solution for u to this equation, which is called the Bianchi identity, for the obvious reasons. Okay. There's an integrability condition that comes along with this, which is if I take that equation and I push down onto the K3 and integrate it over the K3, and you plug in this ansatz, if the classes here are n1 and n2, they're just some integers, right? Then we get that n1 squared plus n2 squared is equal to ch2 tx, or tk3 ts, minus c2 of vs. So this is 24 minus c2 of v for s. Okay. So we have some simple integer equation, which once we've specified the vector bundle, and in particular its second Chern class, we just have to make sure that there are solutions to this. So this is an integrability equation for the existence of a solution. And Fu and Yao go ahead and prove that there exists a solution. And this is a horrifically complicated differential equation, as you can see by just eyeballing the plugging in this ansatz. So the hope of actually finding a solution is pretty much zero.
Sorry, I think I misread what is N1 and N2.
Oh, sorry, N1 and N2 are the, the classes of... Okay, so this guy squared integrates to an integer squared on the K3. Okay. A quick thing to note is... So when is this analysis reliable? As often happens in string theory, this analysis is going to be reliable when the manifold is big and smooth. When the manifold is small, then we're going to get all sorts of corrections to this description. So we want to check to see whether it's consistent to make this manifold large. So to do so, there's a very simple observation, which is, if we scale the metric ds squared by some overall conformal factor, okay, so let's take ds squared x to t squared ds squared x, okay, the Kähler form or the Hermitian form on s on x then just goes to t squared jx, and similarly from this equation h
goes to t squared h. Okay, but it's easy to convince yourself that r mu nu, r the Ricci 2 form, r wedge r, goes to t to the 0, r wedge r. It's invariant under the scaling. Okay, so when you take a solution, so suppose we have a solution, and we rescale it, okay, this sign scales with t squared, this side doesn't scale at all. So this is an inhomogeneous equation in the overall conformal mode, in the global conformal mode. The total volume of this manifold is fixed. Okay. So there's no sense in which it's true that you can take this to large radius. But let's be a little more explicit. We can plug in the ansatz more precisely and see that this scales with n, where the ni's, let me take both of the circle bundles to scale with n, the curvatures. This goes as n squared, and this goes as n to the fourth. Okay, so this equation becomes roughly t squared n squared goes like n to the fourth, or t squared goes like n squared. So it looks like as we take the circle bundles to be highly curved, we wind the S1 many times around the base, we can make the overall volume as large as we want. But this is wrong. The mistake here is that what we've looked at is the overall volume, but we haven't looked at the curvatures. We should have looked at an invariant. So if we look at the Ricci scalar, this goes like, that's clearly a typo, this goes like t to the minus 2 n squared. Okay. So as we crank up n, it looks like this is getting big, except the overall volume is getting small again. The overall volume is getting large as well. So this is always of order 1. So in string theory, this tells us that the supergravity perturbation theory is uncontrolled. Okay, this is a strongly manifold. Even as I try to make it large, it still has regions with curvature of order 1. So we can see this pretty explicitly. So I'll draw you a toy picture, and then you can immediately write down a metric that makes it clear that this is in fact correct. So take one of the S1s in this T2. It's fibered over some P1 in the K3 to give us an S3 in the total space. Okay, nothing surprising there. Now, if you looked at that ansatz, which unfortunately I just erased, the same was ds squared is equal to, on x, is e to the u ds squared on s plus roughly theta, the vertical one-form wedge theta. Okay? Now, the volume of this was fixed to 1. This is just part of the ansatz. The circles are fixed size. So this is fixed to 1. But so how do I change the volume of the manifold? I change the volume of the base. Okay, so I'm going to take the P1 to be very large. And it's going to scale as T. Okay, what does this vibration look like? Well, it is an S3 topologically, but metrically, of course, it's squashed. And very roughly, it looks like some horrendous metric like this. It's a squashed S3. And indeed, if you calculate the metric on this S3, it's squashed, and it has regions where the curvatures are of order 1. So as I make this guy bigger and bigger and bigger, I do nothing about the fact that the total space has curvature which invariantly scales as order 1. This is a slightly cheesy picture of it, but it's correct metrically. Okay, so this is not good, because we have a description which assumes that all the higher order corrections to these equations are small. And that's valid when the manifold is very large. For example, in the flop, you'd say, look, if I have a very large P1, I can just treat it with relativity with GR, and it's just some solution, some extreme of the Einstein-Hilbert term. But as it gets very small, the geometry gets strongly corrected. Right? This is not the correct geometry to use at all. And so in order for this classical analysis to be reliable, we have to also have a limit where all the curvatures are small and all the corrections are small. But that's clearly not the case here. The curvatures are always of order 1. So while it's nice that this set of equations has a solution, it's by no means compelling. We don't even really know that there is a true solution to the string theory. given that there's this approximate solution. So this motivates us to study, to give a different presentation of the geometry that doesn't rely on, or of this manifold that doesn't rely on an approximation of small curvatures. So questions at this point on this particular ensemble. This manifold, a T2 fibration over K3, which is non-Kähler and has H not equal to zero, is called the Fu-Yau compactification or the Fu-Stromager-Yau compactification. There are many, many different names for this manifold, unfortunately. But it's a solution to the Stromager equation, so I think it's reasonable to just refer to it as such. Okay. So what we want is we like...
Can you say again what the statement of Fu and Yau is? Is it that given a T2 fibration over K3, I can find a holomorphic bundle such that these equations are set?
Good, not quite. So what they say is, here's what Fu and Yau would say. If you hand me a K3 with a particular choice of the Kähler form, and you hand me a T2 fibration with a particular choice of the curvatures as elements of H11, and you hand me a holomorphic vector bundle over the K3, I can find a unique solution to these equations modulo the ansatz that I wrote down. Okay, so given this defining data, there's a unique solution. It's a little bit too quick. It's actually a one-parameter family of solutions, where the one parameter you can think about it in many ways, but it's roughly the norm of the three form. From the point of view of string theory, you'd say it's the dilaton. So, stringly, there's always a mixture of the heterotic dilaton and the overall volume modulus, which mix. So you can't stabilize the heterotic dilaton, so you know you always have one parameter family. But anyway, there's a one parameter family which we can think of as just being the overall volume of the normalization of the nowhere vanishing 3 form on our SU3 manifold X. So that's the statement of the Fu-Yau theorem. The various decorations of it. Notably, let me pause before going on to talk about this. Sorry?
For the National League.
Right. Exactly. On Clausius, you know, we don't have the metric on a Clausius. This makes life difficult for many reasons. On the other hand, you know the metric on non-compact Clausius, and so one of the most useful tools in studying Clausius is to study local models. Right? We can learn an awful lot about Clausius by studying local models of degenerations of singularities on a Clausius. So it's totally reasonable to ask the same question here. What about a local model for a Fu-Yau? And exactly in the same way, this is a totally straightforward problem. So let me consider the small resolution of A1. Whoops, I want the small resolution. Here's my P1. Okay. So, small resolution of C2 mod Z2. And I'm going to play the same game. This is non-compact K3. I can play exactly the same game. I'm going to take a T2 fibration over it, X, over this guy, where the curvature is just going to be equal to the volume form on, or the Kähler form on, or the hyperplane class of Iguchi Hansen. Oh, H is a really unfortunate name. Let me just call it omega. There's only one interesting 1-1 form in this geometry. There's a single harmonic 1-1 form, so we'll take it, and that will be our compactification. This is just Iguchi Hansen. We know exactly the metric, right? It's just the metric on the small resolution of P1. We know the 1-1 form in closed form, so you can write down everything in this ansatz. I mean, you can take the bundle to be trivial even, although you can take something more general, but you can take V is equal to completely trivial bundle. And Fu and Yau tell us that there should be a solution for this. We can actually prove the existence theorem much more easily now, because if you take this compactification, again, you only have a single function unspecified, but now by symmetry, it can only depend on the radial distance from the core of the Iguchi Hansen. So there's a single function of a single variable, and if you plug this mess into the Bianchi identity, you get a very explicit ordinary differential equation for one variable. So this now satisfies some extremely standard existence theorems. So by totally garden variety existence theorems for ODEs, there exists a solution for this compactification.
But here's the nice part. We actually have an explicit ordinary differential equation for a metric in terms of, well, the defining data, the metric on the base, but we know the metric on the base. So you can just try to solve this equation. So I have a student who's trying to solve this equation. It would be nice if we had a closed form ODE. It's easy to solve it numerically, but you know, whatever. There's a reason that you might actually care about the numerical solution, or there's a reason I might actually care about the numerical solution, which comes back to an analysis I'll give you in a bit, where we're going to compute exactly what the moduli space is for this example.
What kind of ODE is that? Is this like a Hoyne differential equation?
I'm not sure what classification it falls into. It's a god-awful, hideous differential equation. So I can't give you any better answer than that, unfortunately. I don't know about this stuff. But you can see that it's going to be horribly awful. The metric, it shows up exponentially in the metric. It shows up non-linearly with all sorts of derivatives acting on it. It's not a pretty picture. Okay. Our hope is that there might be some nice presentation, some nice, you know, change of variables where everything works out beautifully, but so far that hasn't happened. Okay. I'm going to skip over most of the sort of technical world sheet story. So let's go back to the K3 case. Okay. So in the K3 case, we obviously can't explicitly solve for the function u, because that differential equation is now built out of the metric on K3, and we don't know the metric on K3. So we're in the standard situation we are in Clavio of not knowing the metric. So we want to be able to compute things without actually knowing the metric. So there's a very cute tool, which is the gauge linear sigma model of Witten. And the basic idea is extremely simple and has, in a rather different context, shown up in the Kapustin-Witten construction for geometric Langlands recently. So I'm going to hijack some of that terminology, or at least some of that notation. So the basic idea here is that we're going to take a 2D gauge theory, and this gauge theory is going to have some moduli space, some Higgs branch moduli space, where in this 2D gauge theory there's some field strength F, and the solutions are going to be roughly of the form F is equal to phi I comma phi j. In the specific models I'm going to be looking at, everything's abelian, so this is just going to be zero, but I won't mention that. So they're going to be either F equals zero, or if we're non-abelian, then F equals commutator, and D of this scalar phi is equal to zero. So this is, incidentally, the Hitchin system. It should look familiar, so there's a reason I call it M sub H. Okay, and there's a nice, so the gauge theory has this moduli space. As I move out on this moduli space and run to low energy or look at long link scales, I just get a nonlinear sigma model on this geometry. But that's exactly what I wanted. I wanted a string theory on this geometry, which is a nonlinear sigma model on the geometry.
H for Higgs or for Hitchin?
Who can tell? Who can ever tell? Here it's for Higgs. Here it's for Higgs. Yes, too bad Hitchin's first name isn't Peter, or Higgs isn't Nigel. There's the Z2 floating around somewhere. Important data here is that there's a one-to-one correspondence between, to each curvature. So suppose there are, the gauge theory has many U1 curvatures. To each curvature F, to each curvature form F, or gauge field strength F, is associated a hyperplane class. Let me give this a label. Is associated a hyperplane class HA in H2 of M. And now I'm just going to drop the subscript altogether. M is just some manifold. Okay. Now the point is, you have a 2D theory, and it flows deep, deep in the infrared at very low energies to a nonlinear sigma model on the manifold M. So now say I wanted to study a nonlinear sigma model on a Clavio. The trick is, find a gauge theory whose moduli space is that Clavio, and then study its low energy limit. That low energy limit should flow to a conformal field theory associated with that manifold M. So my job now becomes engineering a gauge linear sigma model, or a 2D gauge theory, whose Higgs branch moduli space is one of these manifolds. Okay. Now I'm not going to belabor that construction, although I do think it's very beautiful, but I'll tell you a little bit about it.
And then I'll show you what you can use it for. And if you find that interesting, then I invite you to study the construction. But so there's a powerful result in the usual gauge linear sigmoidal story, which goes like this. There's one parameter in the theory, or one set of parameters in the theory, in the gauge theory, the Fi parameters, Fi Eliopoulos parameters. And they show up in the gauge theory as just literally parameters, just numbers that you stick in. What they correspond to geometrically is on the moduli space, the complexified Kähler class on the moduli space takes the form Ta Ha. So the Kähler class is just a sum of hyperplane classes with these parameters being specifying exactly where you are in the Kähler cone. Okay. Now in the gauge theory, the TAs live on a P1. And in particular, there is a special circle where the real part of this goes through 0. And there is a point where t goes to infinity, plus infinity, which is large radius. And as we take this, as we move from this point t equals infinity and tweak that parameter to some point t goes to minus infinity, we get a very different description. We get a Landau-Ginzburg presentation. Of this conformal field theory. Now, this is one quantum field theory. It's a single gauge theory. But it has two different natural presentations depending on where in its parameter space you live. In one region, in one phase, it describes a large radius Clavier. In another phase, which is smoothly connected to it, you have a much more algebraic presentation as a Landau-Ginzburg model. And the nice thing about this is that we can compute the spectrum exactly here. Okay. Let me give you a simple example. A simple example is the small resolution of C2 mod Z2. Okay. Okay. Here, the e to the t is the volume of the small resolution. Okay. As I shrink t to, and I should say this is a Landau-Ginzburg orbifold. So clearly, as t goes to infinity, or t gets very, very large anyway, this is just a smooth, big, fat geometry, the small resolution. As I take t to minus infinity, I get just the orbifold, c2 minus z2, or a1 with perhaps some b-field. And the p1 is shrunk to a point. Okay. Now, this is a singular limit of the geometry, but this is a totally non-singular conformal field theory. It's a perfectly well-behaved conformal field theory. And in particular, we know how to compute the spectrum of this conformal field theory exactly. We have lots of powerful tools for studying it. So this is going to be the basic approach here. So what I want to do is I want to build a gauge theory which has a moduli space whose large radius description, or large t description, is not small resolution of A1, but a T2 vibration over it. Okay? And let me just say that it's possible to do so, rather than go through the construction. Maybe a little physical. So if we build a gauge theory whose moduli space is this guy, we can do it for a compact K3 too, but let me just focus on the non-compact case as a particularly simple example. Then what we get when we flow to the large negative Fi parameter or very small radius phase is again a T2 vibration over this. So very naively, since the vibration can only be non-trivial at the tip because there's no homology anywhere, this looks like C2 times T2 mod Z2. Okay. It turns out to be not exactly that. And the reason is interesting. So in order to understand what it is, let's go back to this gauge theory and just understand one small bit of what's going on. In the gauge theory, I have scalars, and I have some right-moving fermions in the 2D theory. And these come paired up by supersymmetry in the gauge theory. There are also left-moving fermions,
which come in a different multiply. Now, they're coupled to a gauge field, so they have some charges, QM, and these guys have some charges, QI. And in a gauge theory with chiral matter, you run the risk of having an anomaly. So you can compute the anomaly in this theory. It's just the, if you will, diangle diagram. And this goes as sum over the right movers of QI squared minus the sum over the left movers of QM squared. Okay?
I like the word bygone.
Bygone? Okay, so let diangles be bygones. I guess that's... So we'll call this some coefficient A. Okay, so say I take a gauge linear sigmoidal for K3. That specifies these charges because the geometry is given as some symplectic quotient, maybe with a hypersurface in that symplectic quotient. And then I want to specify a vector bundle over it. The specific vector bundle is chosen by the charges QI. Now, if I want to make this gauge theory make sense, this anomaly coefficient had better vanish. So this tells me that there's a specific relation between this vector bundle and the K3. And in particular, remember that to each field strength, or to each gauge field, is associated a hyperplane class. Okay? This is quadratic in gauge fields, which means it's quadratic in hyperplane classes. You can ask, what is this proportional to? What quadratic form on H2 is this? And this is just equal to C2 of T K3 minus C2 of V. Okay? It's some quadratic form explicitly on gauge fields. That means it's some quadratic form on H2. And this is the particular one if you go through and calculate it out. Okay, so the standard trick is set this equal to 0, and you get a non-anomalous gauge theory on this vector bundle over K3. But we could do something slightly more interesting. If you have an anomalous symmetry, you can add axions and a Green-Schwarz mechanism and cancel the anomaly using the Green-Schwarz mechanism. This is the standard thing we do in 10D to make string theory make sense. We can do exactly the same thing in 2D. So we're going to add an extra couple of periodic scalars, theta, such that that couple to the gauge field to cancel the anomaly. Okay? And if you go through, this corresponds to a Lagrangian for the scalars, which looks like d theta plus n times the vector squared plus n theta dA, or n theta f. Okay? If theta were constant, this would just be the theta angle term from the usual gauge linear sigma model. If theta is not constant, this is an axion term, and it's not gauge invariant. And in particular, under gauge transformation, by parameterized by alpha, this goes to L theta plus, and this is crucial, n squared times alpha f. But this is exactly the form of the gauge anomaly in the 2D theory. So if we have n squared is equal to A, then the axion in a Green-Schwarz mechanism, bless you, exactly cancels the anomaly from the fermion content. Okay? But what have we done? We've introduced, so in order to have n equals 2 supersymmetry, I needed to introduce two of these. So I've introduced an extra pair of circles of periodic coordinates. Moreover, they couple to the gauge field, which means they're fibered over the geometry. So I started out with a K3 and a vector bundle that didn't solve the anomaly equations. And end up with a T2 fibration over the K3 and a pullback vector bundle that does solve the anomaly equations, but only by virtue of some non-trivial Green-Schwarz mechanism. That's exactly the Fu-Yau compactification. Okay? So it's just explicitly the Fu-Yau compactification. So now let's go back to this large radius Landau-Ginzburg picture. What's going on here? Yeah.
So, in type 2 cases,
yes,
when one uses a GLSM, mm-hmm, there's a kind of assumption, hand waving due to, space-time properties. You expect that in the conformal limit of this, mm-hmm, theory, you would get a Ricci flat metric on the target.
Right.
So is the assumption here that in the conformal limit, you'll actually get the Fu-Yau?
Yes.
Okay.
And the reason that's a natural thing to expect is this. If you compute the beta function for this theory,
yeah,
it's the Fu-Yau beta functions.
Okay.
So it's exactly the same beta functions as the heterodic nonlinear sigma model. It is a heterodic nonlinear sigma model. So that's right. It's the same set of voodoo assumptions. We don't have any proof that it flows
right.
But But for the same reasons, imagine someone found that it flowed to some other supercontrolled fixed point. That would be even cooler, right? So in some sense, this is the minimal possible assumption that it flows to what you expect it does. Okay, but this anomaly plays a crucial role, an absolutely crucial role for what I'm going to say about the Reed conjecture in a second. Since this U1 is non-trivial, as I run to large negative radius, so the reason I get an orbifold is that at negative radius, I break the U1 to some Zn subgroup. And in this particular case for Gucci-Hansen, I just get a Z2 subgroup. But this U1 is anomalous. That means the Z2 is anomalous. What that means is that if I take this orbifold theory, where I'm acting on the C2 and the T2, but I'm also acting on the left-moving fermions, and I try to write down the partition function for this, it won't be modular invariant. Because modular invariant would be the same as saying that the measure is invariant. I have to include phases coming from this guy. Let me say that more precisely. Naively, I think, just using the standard lore between fractional instantons and twist fields, all of phases of n equals 2, I say, okay, at the Landau-Ginzburg point, or at the large negative radius point, I just get T2 cross C2 with some fermions along for the ride, mod a Z2. And I write down the partition function Z is equal to sum over G and H, where G and H are in Z2, of G H, where this is the G twisted partition function with an insertion of H on the time direction to do the orbifold projection. Okay? You can just check whether this is modular invariant, and it's explicitly not modular invariant. So what do I have to do? I have to add in the phase from the action, e to the A integral of alpha F, where alpha is a gauge transformation in the Z2. This is the thing that I forgot. This is the thing that I totally ignored when I went to the large negative radius phase and told myself that I had a Z2 orbifold. But if you compute this out, integral of F is just equal to the instanton number k, but now upon 2, because we're in an orbifold, and the upon 2 is exactly the number of twist insertions. And alpha is, well, it's Z2, so alpha is a phase upon 2. It's 2 pi I upon 2. So this gives me pi upon 2, k upon 2, the anomaly coefficient times the twist sector, and this is how many orbifold actions I'm acting with. Let me call this G. It's just the how many instantons are or what twist sector I'm in. G H pi I upon 2. Okay. Or equivalently, minus 1 to the anomaly coefficient GH upon 2. If this is non-anomalous, I just get the original theory. Okay, so if the anomaly was 0, then I get T2 times C2 mod Z2, and this is Calabi-Yau as usual. If the anomaly is non-zero, this phase is effective, although it only acts in the twisted sector. It doesn't act in the untwisted sector. So the bulk of the theory is identical, but the twisted sector is different. In particular, the resolution moduli are different. When you turn on the resolution moduli in this new orbifold, they don't give you the blow-up of A1. They give you a non-Kähler manifold, which is a small resolution of this torsion manifold. Small resolution because what you're really blowing up is an S3. Okay. And you can work this out very explicitly in the C2 mod Z2 case and just compute the spectrum. You can actually do it more generally where you have a Landau-Ginzburg orbifold, but it's much messier. Okay. So, finally, what's the point of all this? You can do a really neat thing. Once you have this conformal field theory description of these compactifications, you can do a very nifty thing. Take a T2 fibration. I'm going to take two models. One which is T2 cross C2 mod Z2, okay? And one of which is a T2 fibration over C2 mod Z2, where here the anomaly is 1, and here the anomaly is 0. Or let me just actually take this to be 2, because it's going to make the algebra a little more simple. It doesn't really matter. So the point is there's a vector bundle as well. Over the whole thing. And I've chosen the vector bundles 1 and 2 so that they either cancel off C2 of the tangent bundle or that they don't cancel off the C2 of the tangent bundle. Okay. So in this case, I have H is equal to 0. It's completely Kähler, DJ equals 0.
and I have just the Calabi out compactification, T2 times C2 over K3. Here, H is not equal to 0, and in particular, DH is not equal to 0, and I have a non-Kähler manifold. But this has a one-parameter moduli space. Actually, it has a many-parameter moduli space because the T2 has a modulus. I can change the radius of the T2. So, times moduli space of the T2. And this is this single P1, the volume of the small resolution. Okay. And over here, I have the volume of the small resolution, which now is really controlling an S3 rather than a T2. But I don't have the moduli space for the T2 because it's frozen to be at a particular radius. In particular, it was frozen to be, if you're careful about factors of two, it's self-dual radius, which is suggestive. The reason that's suggestive is, let me take this, the moduli space of this T2 to be at a particular point, which is the self-dual radius. So it's at the same radius as the torus fiber here. Okay. What's going on over here is that under the gauge group, the T2 coordinates, which I'll call theta, are gauge invariant, and they don't contribute to the anomaly. There's no Green-Schwarz mechanism. But the left-moving fermions are non-gauge invariant, and they contribute to the anomaly. So let me phrase this as the contribution to the anomaly from theta is equal to 0, and the contribution from left-moving fermions is not equal to 0. It's equal to 2. Okay. On this side, the contribution to the anomaly from the two periodic coordinates is equal to 2. That's because we have to cancel off the anomaly. And the contribution from the left-moving fermions is equal to 0. I've just turned them off. That's why I had an anomaly in the first place. Okay. Now here's the great thing. If I run down to the large negative radius point on K3, if I go to the orbifold point, okay, so this is a non-Kähler manifold, and this is a special subslice of the moduli space of a Kähler manifold. If I go to t goes to minus infinity, which here is the volume of an S3, or sorry, of a P1, and here t is the volume of an S3, at these two points, where I shrink down on one side of the S3 and shrink down on the other side of P1, the conformal field theories are isomorphic. And what I mean by that is there's a change of variables where I take lambda minus and I fermionize it to give me an e to the h. Okay? And I take the T2 coordinate, e to the theta, and I fermionize it to get a chi minus. I bosonize the fermion exactly and fermionize the boson. Okay? Now on the world sheet, this is terribly non-local. You're changing what you're considering a good local operator in the world sheet theory. It's a horribly non-local thing. From the space-time, what's going on? Well, from the space-time point of view, let's look at the Kähler side. What I've got is T2 times a singularity, and all the interesting business is happening at the shrunken down singularity. On the other side, I have everywhere away from the singularity a T2 times... Okay, and at the singularity, something interesting is going on with the T2. Well, over here, something interesting was going on at the singularity too. We had a vector bundle over it that was non-trivial, that canceled off the curvature of the tangent bundle. Here, what's canceling off the curvature of the tangent bundle is the fibration being non-trivial at the singularity, even though it's trivial everywhere else. Okay, so what I'm doing is shrinking down, and then not paying attention to what I'm doing. I'm doing something horribly non-local at the singularity, at the blown down P1. And when I close my eyes and I bosonize and I fermionize and I open my eyes again, I switch from one presentation to the other. But it's the same conformal field theory. You're just changing what you define as local and non-local operators. Okay. So note that in order to do this, you had to go to a very special point in the moduli space of the T2. You had to go to self-dual radius. So in these coordinates, another way to phrase this is that in these coordinates, in this presentation of fermionization and bosonization, what are natural, mutually local vertex operators that I can turn on and resolve the geometry are a different set than in this coordinate, in this set of coordinates. So that's why there seem to be more moduli over here than over here. What mutually local means, so that I can turn operators on, has changed.
Okay. So while these are identical as conformal field theories, as string theories, they're not. Because in string theory, I'm picking a particular choice of mutual locality. Right? I can't turn on both winding and momentum modes. I pick a consistent set of what are canonically commuting operators. Okay. So from the point of view of this conformal field theory, then.
So this is the opposite of the original transition story, where in conformal field theory they didn't connect, but in string theory they did.
Right.
Here in string theory they don't connect, but in conformal field theory they do.
Yeah, I'm confused about exactly what's going on in the string theory for the following reason. Suppose I take string theory on this compactification. Okay? And first off, let me start on this slide. Suppose I take string theory on this manifold. I've turned on an axion, which means there's no Coulomb branch. The gauge theory is always Higgs. Okay? So this is a completely non-singular conformal field theory. There's no singularity anywhere in the moduli space of this conformal field theory. There's no Coulomb branch where you could worry about getting a non-compact direction. Right? The theta branch isn't there, or the sigma branch isn't there. Okay. Now, as I run down to small radius, I think, oh, damn, it really would be appealing to fermionize this boson and bosonize this fermion. And then I get something that looks like a Calabi-Yau. But here's the problem. I've already coupled this to 0-1 supergravity in a way which is local on the world sheet. If I start mucking around with what's local and what's not local, I'll end up with a non-locally coupled supergravity theory. And I'm not sure what the rules are there. Now, usually we work in string theory, we've gauge fixed everything. And then maybe you bosonize the superconformal ghosts, and for me, I mean, it just doesn't make sense. So I don't know what the right story is in the string theory. What I can say sharply is that at the level of what are the set of mutually local operators that I can turn on as vertex operators, they change when you bosonize and fermionize. So I'll leave the question of exactly what's going on in the string theory as a puzzle, but as you say, it looks very much unlike it looks like the opposite of the usual case. Yeah. If you just ask at the level of the conformal field theory, they're just isomorphic conformal field theories. One is horribly non-local. You know, if you turn on the, for example, the moduli for the T2 here and deform away from being itself dual radius, that looks like a horribly non-local deformation of this conformal field theory. It's allowed. It's just not a local deformation of the theory. It's some non-local deformation of the theory, which is fine. It just doesn't have a particularly nice presentation in terms of this geometry. But you can work with the other coordinates. So I guess what I'll close with is what we found is a couple of moduli spaces which you might want to say think of as sort of kissing cousins where you smoothly move from one to the other, but I think it's better understood as here's the Calabi-Yau moduli space and here's a submoduli space of it, and this submoduli space of it has a different set of coordinates. So this is M Calabi-Yau. We've just chosen a particular set of coordinates in the conformal field theory, and I can move well beyond what are the natural Calabi-Yau, what would naively be the boundary of the Calabi-Yau moduli space, because this is just a totally different local presentation. So one way the Reed fantasy could be realized is that I move far away from this Calabi-Yau on the moduli space of this now non-Kähler presentation of the conformal field theory. And then over here, again, bosonize and fermionize to discover myself on a moduli space of some other Calabi-Yau prime. Okay. Anyway, the crucial thing, I think, is that these transition points can be accessed and studied directly at the level of the conformal field theory. And all the conformal field theory is doing is, in some sense, computing the exact quantum cohomology for that particular geometry. It's just stepping back a bit from the geometry but asking the same cohomology question. So I don't have any broad statement about the Reed fantasy, except to say that I think one of the places to go about studying the Reed fantasy is in the context of conformal field theory, where it's a surprising amount can be done. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? I have a question. Maybe you could explain this point again with the gauge, two-dimensional gauged linear and nonlinear sigma model.
Yeah.
So how did this work? So I fix the Calabi-Yau manifold I want to consider, and then I build my gauge theory.
Yes.
So I'm a little bit confused. What's the two-dimensional manifold, the gauge theory,
yeah,
and so on? And
okay, so we'll take it to be the plane or P1 as you deem appropriate. But let's say P1, which is the most natural thing to do. So in this 2D theory, we have a 2D gauge theory, and there are a bunch of scalars, okay, and they have some charges QI. And there's a bunch of vectors. Let me just take a U1 gauge theory. Let me give you an example. Let me give you two simple examples of a gauge linear sigma very quickly. So the first is a U1 theory, which has two fields, a field of charge phi1 and phi2 with charge 1 and minus 1. Okay? So let's write down this, the Lagrangian for this theory. It's D plus A phi1 squared plus D minus A phi2 squared plus a D term, a scalar potential, which looks like phi1 squared minus phi2 squared minus R, the Fi parameter squared. We call this T. Okay. So in order to minimize the scalar potential, to look at the vacuum solutions, we need to solve this because this has to be 0. Okay, so let's take, again, t is some P1 valued parameter. Let's take t to be very large and positive. So let's take the real part of t to be very large and positive, which is greater than plus 1. Minimizing this forces phi2 to 0, or phi2 to be, t is large and positive. That means phi1 has to be large and positive to cancel it off, because this will give us a strictly negative contribution. Okay. So if phi1 is large and much greater than 1, then the gauge field here is getting a mass term from the kinetic term. So the gauge field is Higgs. Okay? So A is massive. The overall size of phi1 is fixed by the D term. And the phase of phi we can just absorb as the longitudinal part of the vector. It's a massive vector. It eats a Goldstone boson. It's the scalar. So A is massive, and so we can just lift these guys, and what's the solution we get at the end of the day? The solution we get is phi2 squared is T. So, or sorry, the phi2 is now left unconstrained. There's no mass term for phi2. So phi1 becomes massive, A becomes massive, and the only field remaining is phi2. And if you look at the effective theory is free. So it's free. So what's the moduli space of a free theory with a scalar? Well, just C. Similarly, if you take, this was for a real part of t much greater than 1. If t is much less than minus 1, we have exactly the same story, but with phi2 not equal to 0. Right? Okay. So therefore, we get, again, a nonlinear sigma model on C. So this so far looks really stupid. It looks totally uninteresting. Let's do a more interesting example, and you'll start to see how the geometry comes about. So the more interesting example is going to add one more field, a field we'll call P, and these are going to have charges +1, +1, and -2. Okay? So, and again, we have a D-term potential, which looks like phi1 squared, now plus phi2 squared, -2P squared, minus T. I'm just going to use the real part of T, which is R squared. So we have to extremize this potential. Okay? So, again, we have two regimes. One is R much greater than +1. So if R is large and positive, phi1 and phi2, at least one of them has to be non-zero. Okay? So one of these guys gets massive, and we use the vector, which gets a mass as a consequence, to eat the phase of one of these guys. So what we really have is a set of solutions, phi1 squared plus phi2 squared, 2 squared, is equal to R. So this is an S3. But we have the quotient out by the U1 action, by the gauge action, mod U1, which is just a P1. Okay? And the P1 is of radius R. Okay? So from the phi1 and phi2, we get a P1 of radius R. Okay? But we still have the P field left over. Okay? And what does this do? Well, for every value of the P field, the effective R just changes. And this is strictly positive. So what we get is, if I now plot P, here's the VEV of phi, then at p equals 0, I get a p1 of radius r, and at every other value of p, I get a much larger sphere of radius r plus p, or root r squared plus p squared.
Okay, and if you're careful about the metric, how do you get the metric? Well, when A was massive, we just integrate out the vector A, and you get an effective A of phi is equal to phi bar d phi upon sum on phi squared. This comes from literally just integrating out A as an auxiliary variable because it's massive. So when you plug this back in, you get an effective Lagrangian. L is equal to d plus A now of phi, phi squared, sum on I. And so the surviving phi in the P field, you should do this for all of these. But what is this? If you just rewrite this, this becomes some effective metric, g of phi, d phi squared, d phi, d phi, where I'm now including P as one of the phis with the label I, which is a little bit gross, I, j. Okay. So this is just a nonlinear sigma model, where because of this connection, the effective connection depended on the scalars, the Higgs vevs, so does the effective metric. Okay. So you just get the metric, the effective metric on the moduli space from integrating out the vector. Here, if you're careful about what metric exactly you get, what you find is you get a Cauchy-Hansen, or equivalently. So this is a P1 that's nowhere vanishing. It's not shrinking to zero at anywhere, but it has a smallest radius, which is a radius R. And if you're careful about the metric, it's just a Cauchy-Hansen, which is a small resolution of A1, where e to the r is the volume of the small resolution. Okay, so you can go through and do this. So let's do the same thing now at large negative radius, r much less than minus 1. When r is much less than minus 1, then p has to be non-zero. But only p can be non-zero, so we integrate it out. And just like before, these guys are free. Okay. Except what changes is, so p is not equal to 0. This breaks the U1 gauge group, but it doesn't completely break it, because it has charge 2. So there's a Z2 subgroup of the gauge group, which leaves the VEV of p invariant. So this breaks U1 to Z2. So what we have left are two free fields, phi1 and phi2. So naively, this is C2. The moduli space should be C2. But we have to further quotient by the Z2. Okay, so when this parameter, the FI parameter in our gauge theory, is large and positive, we get a large smooth geometry, which is a small resolution. And as we blow it down, we get this particular, the small resolution. So this is exactly the way that you play the game in general for building a Clavier. For a non-compact case, you do this. To compactify, you'll build some projective space and turn on some hypersurfaces with some superpotential. But the basic gig is this. You have some symplectic or a holomorphic quotient, which is affected by the gauge group. And you study the various regimes of the parameter space to get the various phases of the geometry. To do it in generality for Clavier, it's another 10 minutes, but it's not that complicated. Is that a fair generalization or statement of the gauge linear sigma model?
Any more questions? Let's take a look at it.
Unfortunately, the